Welcome to NPR's roundup of the week's very best arts and cultural stories. I am Neda Ulibi. This week, an all-music edition of Culturetopia. Trent Reznor of the band Nine Inch Nails discusses writing the Oscar-winning score for the movie The Social Network. New York-based DJ Rekha talks about Bhangra, the infectious beat from India heard now in clubs across the U.S. And Moombaton, a genre of dance music spawned by accident and built around an international community. But first,
Morning Edition Steve Inskeep is reporting from Cairo on what comes after the revolution there. The generals who now control Egypt promised to bring democracy, though that means more than just elections.
In recent days, we've reported on building blocks of democracy here, like the protection of minorities, the drive for a more independent press, or the right to privacy from government spies. We're also finding out how the state treats those who dissent. Some of the protesters who thought they won when Hosni Mubarak left have found out they haven't won yet. And this is the story of what happened after Mubarak to a young man known as the Singer of the Revolution. We're listening to a song about Mubarak called Leave. A little-known young guitarist put protest chants to music. Thousands sang along as he played the song on stage in Tahrir Square. It became a hit on YouTube, and the protest singer became a celebrity.
My name is Rami Assam, and I'm 23 years old.
Rami Assam is an architecture student at Mansour University on the Mediterranean coast. Ever since I was young, I liked to draw, he says, but his heart's not really in architecture. He loves music, Linkin Park, Limp Bizkit, Nirvana. After the revolution made him famous, he went into a recording studio. This song sarcastically declares, bend your head, you're living in a democracy. It suggests that Egypt's democracy is not real yet. 6 days ago, Rami Assam played a concert in Cairo. Later, he dropped by Tahrir Square, which protesters were still occupying. And so by chance, he was present when the army swept into the square without warning and ripped down protesters' tents, as captured on a YouTube video. The army arrested more than 100 people, including the singer Rami Assam. He says men in army uniforms dragged him to the Egyptian National Museum, which had become a security headquarters. By the time the army released him, he could barely walk. When we met Rami Assam, he was lying face down on the same twin bed he slept in as a child. His shirt was off, and the blanket was pulled down halfway. He didn't want anything touching the red gashes and welts all over his back. What are the injuries on your back? He says that men in army uniforms took him to a courtyard, stripped him to his shorts, beat him, and more.
In addition to that, there's a soldier and an officer who jumped into the air and going down on his head with his leg.
So you say they used a whip, they used a stick, they used metal rods, they stomped on your head, and electricity. I'm sorry to ask this question. Where did they apply the electricity?
All over his
body.
He says he couldn't see exactly since his face was on the ground, but he could feel it. In one way, Rami Assam may be lucky. He was, at least, released. Many civilians arrested in recent weeks have been taken before military courts as the government seeks to maintain control of the streets. Last night, the army had yet to make a formal statement on Rami Assam's case. Yet even with the marks on his back, the singer of the revolution refuses to condemn the army as a whole. He says, we still believe there are honest people who will investigate what happened. As Rami Assam speaks, the family apartment is filled with friends. They're smoking cigarettes and waiting to help if needed. The young man's mother is in the kitchen, cooking a huge pot of macaroni. People smile when Rami and his brother Shadi recall how their mother feared for them when they joined the revolution. What did your mother say when you went out and started protesting?
In the very beginning, she was very, very afraid, and she went, I will come after you. But after that, we have said again and again, we are okay, mother. You have born men, not just young people, and we can do it. She believed in us, and she believed that Rami is a big hero.
When You got hurt? Did your mother say, I told you so? Yes, they say. Even in pain, Rami Assam smiles. And if that seems strange, just consider that one of Rami Assam's songs is called Laugh Revolution.
You can hear more of Rami Assam's protest songs at nprmusic.org.
This is some of the haunting and delicate music from the film The Social Network. The score won an Oscar at the Academy Awards last month, and for millions of fans of the industrial goth band Nine Inch Nails, a band that became huge in the 1990s, there was a moment of almost jaw-dropping surprise that night. The man behind Nine Inch Nails, Trent Reznor, also composed the music for The Social Network, and when his name was announced, a clean-cut, tuxedo-clad Reznor bounced on stage to hold high his Oscar. The same man who, for much of the 1990s, personified a dark and sometimes estranged voice in the world of rock. This is the Trent Reznor most of his fans know. Reznor's influence on rock in the 1990s cannot be overstated. It was huge. And it turns out his influence in the film world may be even more profound. Trent Reznor is here in the studio with me, fresh from his Oscar glory. Welcome to the program.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
Head Like a Hole, this is a song we're hearing. It came out more than two decades ago. When you hear it, when you listen to it, do you still identify with the person singing those words?
No, I do. I just spent some time with that record because we re-released it and remastered it. And so I had to actually clinically kind of listen to it. In my early 20s, I had this kind of need to express myself that would have come out as punching a wall or writing a poem or screaming or whatever it might be. And it wound up being marrying a journal I'd been keeping with music I was writing. And this weird kind of concoction came out that had a truth to it because I meant it. You know,
I mean, it's well known you suffered from depression for a while, and some of that was in your music.
Yeah, I hadn't been diagnosed at that point, and later in my life, you know, there was addiction involved that reared its head later, but certainly music was a cathartic way for me to express myself, and I think that there was an integrity and an honesty in that that other people related to, and for me, it felt like, well, I found this perfect vehicle to get this out of my system. And when we started playing live, I'd see people yelling lyrics back at me that I've never met, that I wrote in the privacy of my bedroom in some state. And, you know, it felt like there was an interesting back and forth connection. And that kind of defined what that first chunk of my career became. And over time, anytime a new project comes up, it's really just a matter of mining into my own feelings and my own thoughts, and that place I'm in has changed, you know, as I would hope it would. You know, it went from a place of pretty dark and unbearable to what it is now, you know, which has lots of nice things in it.
David Fincher, the director of The Social Network, he could have asked anyone to score this film. He asked you, and I read that you were somewhat reluctant. Was that true?
Yeah, when he first asked me, I'd just finished several years of touring, and I wasn't particularly feeling creative. You know, it's like it takes a bit of time to shift gears from execution, playing shows and worrying about physically being able to do it, to that quiet, contemplative time where good ideas can get snatched out of the air, and I wasn't in that mode. So I told David, look, I don't think I can do it. In fact, I can't do it right now. Several months later, things had kind of turned around in my world. I started writing, was working on some other things. It was nagging me that I felt I'd disappointed him. And I got in touch with him just to say, listen, sorry again, and in the future, just if anything else ever comes up, let me know. And he said, well, I'm still waiting on you to say yes to this film. You know? He had filmed it in the meantime.
Wow. So he didn't go ahead and find another composer.
No. So it was waiting. I got in my car that day, went over, and we were off to the races.
In the opening scene of the movie, the Mark Zuckerberg character, played by Jesse Eisenberg, is getting dumped by his girlfriend. And he's obviously humiliated. He then goes back, darts across what is filmed as the Harvard campus, and we hear this music. There's that lonely piano and that almost ominous sound behind it. I read that Aaron Sorkin, the screenwriter, was very specific in the script. He wanted this energetic, stomping, pumping tune there, and you completely defied that.
Sorry, Aaron. No, I mean, that is one of my proudest achievements, that moment in this film. Mm-hmm. And honestly, not just in this film, just in everything I've done, is when I first saw that inserted in that place, it really felt like, hey, we're onto something. And I think it did an excellent job of framing the film in a way where your expectations are differently. I'd seen a rough edit of that with an Elvis Costello song in there. Mm-hmm. And it becomes a different film. It becomes a familiar, oh, it's Guys at College. You know, it's...
Yeah.
This took it into a place where it felt unfamiliar, and it felt there was a tension, there's a sense of remorse, there's a kind of noble melody being played in this kind of sad-sounding piano that lacks any confidence, and it's in this icy kind of landscape of electronics and that feels familiar yet unfamiliar.
I'm speaking with Trent Reznor. He's the frontman for Nine Inch Nails. He recently won the Academy Award for Best Original Score for the film The Social Network. Mark Zuckerberg, at least as he is portrayed in the film, played by Jesse Eisenberg, is an anti-hero. And in the past, you've been described exactly that way as well. Did you feel any affinity with his character?
I did. You know, and really the way... The score came about, the thought process behind it was first try to get out of David what he wanted. What's the film about? It's not about Facebook, first and foremost. Facebook could be anything, really.
Yeah.
It's about a kind of flawed character that is in search of that defining idea, that thing that gives him a sense of purpose, that validates his life, someone that never really fit in. Someone that's angry and someone that pursues and chases that idea at any cost. And when you distill it down to that, which is what it meant to me, those are definitely themes I can relate to. And this has no real bearing on the real Mark Zuckerberg, who I've never met and
right.
don't know.
Right.
It's the character that was written, and that was my job to interpret what's on the page.
You and Atticus Ross, who shared this Oscar with, are now scoring another David Fincher film, The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. I'm assuming you must have had a good time doing The Social Network because you agreed to take on another movie project, another David Fincher project.
The act of working on the film, the entire experience was unmatched. And
Unmatched with
anything I've done in my life.
Wow.
Certainly creatively. And that includes playing sold-out shows and whatever else I've achieved with Nine Inch Nails. So when we finished... David asked if we were interested in Dragon Tattoo, and I didn't have to think about it. It was like, this would be an experience, an opportunity to work on a film that's very different than Social Network and try something very different that does have landscapes and expanse and try to figure out how to solve that problem.
It sounds like you are at a really great place in your life.
You know, I feel pretty good about things, to be honest with you. I found a wonderful woman I'm married to. I have a new son. And I've kind of gotten out of the way and let life happen. And it's been going pretty great, you know. And coming out of a dark period 10 years ago, I got sober. And I have very little to complain about. And I think what this film helped do was... bring in a new breath of optimism in terms of my relationship with music and my career.
That's Trent Reznor. He's best known as the frontman for Nine Inch Nails. Last month, he won the Academy Award for Best Original Score for his work on the film The Social Network. Trent Reznor, thank you so much.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Every day, it seems, some new buzzword pops up to describe the latest sound in music. There are countless new genres and subgenres to the point where it becomes hard to keep up, and even harder to figure out where the latest craze came from. Well, fortunately, NPR has Sammy Yenigun to clue us into the latest in dance music. It's called Mumbaton, and it started here in Washington, D.C.
It all started at a skipping party.
In hopes of not getting anyone in trouble, yeah, a skipping party is when kids basically play hooky and throw a basement party at their friend's house.
Dave Natta's one half of the duo Nattastrum. He's a DJ and a producer from Washington, D.C. In 2009, at the request of his little cousin, Natta agreed to spin for a group of class-cutting kids. But when he showed up to play, there was a problem.
The kids that were all there were listening to not what I would be playing. They were listening to reggaeton and bachata, like Latin music. I was like, all right, I don't want to mess up the vibe and play fast techno electro club music. This is the kind of music I had, and I thought to myself, I was like, well, what if I slow down these records that I have? And I slowed down this one track called Mumba, and lo and behold, it popped off.
When Natta saw the crowd reaction, he knew he'd struck gold. And this is how dance music's hottest new genre began. At a basic level, Mumbaton is a cross between Dutch house music and reggaeton, a blend of West Indian and Latin styles that grew up in Puerto Rico. Natta added to this foundation
Latin vocals and certain rhythms like the popular action rhythm. There's dembo, which is like doom. Or like a cumbia like shake where it's like. And also thinking about certain arrangements in house music where the beat drops out and you have really dramatic builds and then the beat comes back in.
The bass drops. We can do it.
These parts all come together at a slowed down tempo of 108 beats per minute. Unlike most genres, the sound took hold internationally before it got big in any one place. DJ Diplo, who has a reputation for exposing smaller genres to larger audiences, explains.
It was global from the beginning. With something like dubstep, that was sort of like censored in London and then moved to, you know, America and Canada and, you know, Australia. But the Mumbaton, it just happened everywhere, man. I was getting things from all over the place.
One of those places was Rotterdam, where the 21-year-old producer Munchi first heard Dave Natta's work online. A Dutchman of Dominican descent, he couldn't believe what he'd found.
When I heard that, it was like, this is what I have to do, this is what I was searching for. And then the same night that I heard it, I made the whole Mumbaton EP and put it online. And then after that, kind of blew up, you know.
Putting his own work online, Munchi's gained a lot of attention and has already spawned a group of subgenres with names like Mumbacore, Mumbastep, Mumbachero, and Mumbasoul. Mumbasoul, for example, keeps Mumbaton's tempo and rhythms, but samples soul records instead of Latin records for a sexier feel. In the the upcoming months, Diplo's label Mad Decent is putting out a Moombahton compilation that will feature work from Dave Nada, Munchi, and many more producers who met each other over an internet connection.
It's like a whole community thing, like a family, I guess.
And it's a family that looks out for its members. Just 2 days after I spoke to Munchi, he suffered an intracerebral hemorrhage and fell into a coma. He's since woken and is recovering, but he's been slammed with medical bills. These friends that he's made online, through making Moombahton, they're throwing him a party in April to help pay his expenses. Sammy Yenigan, NPR News.
And you can hear more Moombahton at our music news blog at npr.org/the record.
You may or may not know the word bunga, but you have probably heard that beat. The music you're hearing is Basement Bhangra, featuring hip-hop artist Wyclef Jean. The woman behind that anthem is Rekha Malhotra, who records and performs as DJ Rekha. She DJs parties in New York and around the country and hosts a weekly online radio show, Bhangra and Beyond, on Breakthrough Radio. Bhangra is a genre of music and dance known for its drum beats and lively rhythms. It originally hails from the Indian state of Punjab, but it's made its way into clubs across the country and has caught the ear of well-known artists like Missy Elliott, Sean Paul, and Jay-Z, who has performed a number of hits with Bhangra artist Punjabi MC. Now, it just happens that DJ Rekha is in Washington, D.C. for a huge Indian culture festival at the Kennedy Center called Maximum India, and she was nice enough to stop by our studios here in D.C. to share her latest work. Welcome. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Now, let's get right to some of the music. Many of the songs that you've produced have elements of hip-hop or electronic beats. We'll just play one just to get us started. Here it is. You're actually pretty well known and loved by the NPR audience. But for those who don't know your story, can you just tell us how you got involved with both Bhangra and hip hop?
Well, I grew up in New York City, in a suburb of New York, Westbury, Long Island, around the time, without revealing too much about my age, when hip hop was just coming to the fore. Everyone at school had a cousin or somebody that was 2 degrees away from Run DMC or LL Cool J, because we were closer to the Queens side of hip hop. So I was around that music, and then when I was around 15, my mom brought back a tape from England of this Bhangra artist, Malkeet Singh, and it kind of blew me away. We didn't really listen to that kind of music at home. We listened to more Bollywood stuff, which is the music from the Hindi film industry. Bhangra is more of a folk music. And then a few years later, after I heard that tape, I heard another, I guess, a mashup or a mix by an artist named Bali Sagu, which sampled pieces of hip-hop, Martin Luther King, all that stuff with the vocals from this artist. And I guess it all just came together for me then, and I really liked it. Next thing I knew, me and my cousins were scraping together our pennies. I was breaking in a credit card, started volunteering for parties, and here I am today.
Now, people call you the ambassador of Bhangra, in part because you kind of help people appreciate it in all these different genres. Like, fusion is another word that people use to just kind of describe what you've put together. How do you think about it?
I guess I just really like the music, and I like people to like the music, and I like to share the music. So I'm happy to have opportunities to do it. I'm happy there's an audience for it. I have never played this music for somebody who hasn't liked it.
And in fact, what do you think people like about it? It's interesting the way it has really become global.
The music that we're used to listening to in terms of contemporary music is a lot of four on the floor. Everyone says 1, 2, 3, 4, all electronic beats. And most of the electronic music or the dance music you listen to actually has a connection to dub music, which comes from Jamaica. So Bhangra lends itself to all these styles of music. It mixes in well rhythmically to all these styles of music. It's very energetic. It just works. I mean, it's just a great vibe. I mean, I get that feeling when I hear a good hip-hop song or hear a good bhangra song, I get the same smile on my face. So they kind of work together.
Now, let's play another clip, and then you can tell us about it and see if everybody else gets that smile on their face. I bet they do. Here it is. What do we have in here? Portuguese, Hindi. What else is going on?
That's a lot going on. That track is actually not a bhangra track.
Oh.
So I don't just exclusively produce or work with bhangra.
Okay.
That track is it's called Pyar Baile. It's I guess it's a cover of a popular Hindi film song from the 70s. And I collaborated with my friend Dave Sharma, who also produced the previous track we heard. And we got two great vocalists. The Hindi vocalist re-sang the original lyrics, and the Brazilian vocalist, Zizuka Ponderosa, she wrote original Portuguese rap. And so Dave and I had done a gig together in Brazil many years ago. He's a percussionist as well as a producer. And we came back and we were working on stuff. We just go in the studio and try to come up with ideas, and we were so inspired that these things just came together. It took us a long time to actually finish the darn thing, but that's what it was, and I really like that style of dance music. I like anything that makes people dance.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin, and I'm speaking with DJ Reka. She's a critically acclaimed DJ and producer who has helped popularize South Asian music in the United States. She's also the founder of the popular Basement Bhangra Party in New York City. It's my understanding, and I could be wrong about this, not being an expert, but it's my understanding that as a folk music and dance, bhangra has mostly been danced by men. Is that right? And so I'm just wondering, mm-hmm. if you've ever gotten any resistance from, you know, that side of the cultural equations, just saying this is really not for you.
Sure. I mean, there's a lot of debate around certain aspects of bhangra. Bhangra, if one would technically break it down, it is a male folk dance. It is a very specific rhythm, actually. So what is considered bhangra today is one of many rhythms, not exactly the bhangra rhythm. But as language evolves, culture moves forward, things start to mean other things. So bhangra has become sort of a ubiquitous term to describe a certain style of music. And it's definitely a battleground for tradition versus modernity. So in the United States, what we've seen, which is very unique to North America, is the emergence of bhangra dance teams on college campuses. In fact, D.C. is the host of Bhangra Blowout every year, which has been going on for 17 years or so. And what's interesting to look at those dances over time is they're basically, some of them are inventing tradition. Each year, and I've gone, you know, sporadically, they try to get more and more traditional. And for you in Radioland, I've got finger quotes up. and the tradition is sometimes invented. So I haven't necessarily been personally challenged on the maleness of it, but more about like the, oh, that's not real music. That's not where it should be. It was like this. You mix stuff. I mean, to me, once you record something, tradition goes out the window. Indian music, South Asian music, was never meant to be recorded. It was meant to be experienced live. So once you enter the recording technology in the equation, that's the first step of changing things. So music and culture keeps moving. There's no point in time where bhangra was traditional and it was there and then all of a sudden it changed. So the word bhangra has an interesting history in how it got used and how it came to represent Punjab, how it got further used in the UK. Someone made an album called Bhangra Fever. All of a sudden that Punjabi music started being called bhangra and so on and so forth. And even in the parlance of music writing and stuff, people call everything bhangra that has a South Asian sound to it, and may or may not be so.
DJ Reka, do you have a PhD on the side? Are you kind of...
No, I do
is
not.
Is there like by day, you like by night, hot DJ Reka, and by day, like PhD anthropologist, ethnomusicologist? Is that a secret?
No,
life
I
that
do
you're
teach part-time at NYU. Shout out to Clive Davis, Department of Recorded Music, a.k.a. Remu, but... Yeah.
Well, thank you for that lesson and breaking it down. But before I let you go, I'd mention that you're in town for the Kennedy Center's Maximum India Festival, which runs through March 20th. And it's a global festival. I mean, there are all manner of genre of, you know, art, dance, and music, some from what many people consider the kind of classical Indian dance from some traditions. And I don't want to say to you all the way sort of to you. I am curious about your thoughts about being included in this festival. I mean, on the one hand, you are American. I mean, you couldn't be any more American, really, if you don't mind my saying so. So what is your thought about being part of this festival?
It's always great to be amongst talented folks. If festivals are the way that people draw audiences, for me it's exciting because I don't get to play a lot of shows that are free and for all ages. So the fact that I get to do that, and they often come through cultural events, I'm happy. I'm just glad to be a part of something that's this big. What's great about the festival is that it went to the efforts to bring people in internationally. Some of the highlights of the festival for me are Raghu Dixit Project. Also, my buddy Punjabi MC is also playing. So that's some of the more contemporary stuff or stuff that sort of mixes contemporary old and new. And also the film series is really exciting. They've got really great filmmakers, Nandita Das, Shabana Azmi. On the literature side, Siketu Mehta, who's also writing a book on New York now. So if it was the only thing that was ever going to get programmed, sure. But it's not. It's the beginning, I hope.
Rekha Malhotra records and performs as DJ Rekha, is a critically acclaimed producer and the founder of Basement Bhangra, a monthly dance party in New York City. She's in town for the Kennedy Center's Maximum India Festival, which runs through March 20th, and she was kind enough to join us at our studios here in Washington, D.C. And if you like the music you heard, you can check out her weekly online radio show, Bhangra and Beyond, on Breakthrough Radio. DJ, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That's it for this week. You can find links to all the stories we have today and subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. I am Neda Ulibi. Thanks for listening to Culturetopia. So long.